I am leading the Dharma talk, the discussion today, and I'm really grateful to be here. I'm excited and frightened. I spent a good time of the meditation crying because I'm becoming. This is a great topic because I'm really experiencing becoming in this role. This is my very first Dharma talk for Sunday and my second Dharma talk in my life. So there's a lot of becoming here. And I have to look at my clock here. I'm supposed to end around 11. Okay, so for those of you, so please, it takes a village, right? And I look forward to how this lands with you. And so for those who are new, we are continuing exploring the 12 links of dependent origination, or the Buddha's teachings on how this process of suffering, dis-ease, unsatisfactoriness, life exists, and possibilities of relating to and responding to experiences in life differently. So we're attempting to understand the law of cause and effect relationships or conditioning. And so we've just come from the door, I like to say, of clinging, which is attachment to sensual pleasures, views, opinions, rituals, this sense of right and wrong, and this sense of solidity in the way things are. And we talked about these distortions that we get or we experience when we think things should be permanent when they are not, or think things should be, pleasurable and they're not. So we're looking at the 10th link of becoming. And one of the images that I've seen is of a pregnant woman. So this is like a becoming. It's a verb. And a process that is produced in our minds and through our actions. And Christina Feldman describes becoming as a constant process happening countless times a day through all our days. It's alive and moving in our behaviors, our actions, our thoughts, our intentions. They all align. They come to a point in to having to be somebody, to become somebody, to have something, and other than what simply is an experience. And she says that this becoming can be habitual and lead to a sense of identity for ourselves, like I'm angry, I'm just an angry person, or I'm not good at math. Or, a belief like that. I'm not good at math. And then a whole world is created from that view and actually reflected back. And another way of putting it, it's a type of being that follows on doing, a doing in anticipation of what will become. So last week, Lindell had these great story on a Nordic tale about Moomins. And I wrote down, basically, there were three Moomins who had this identity. One had an identity around doing, keeping busy doing. And another had an identity around having, must have possessions. And another one was much more neutral, if you will, without preferences, kind of just to live was okay. And I have a poem I want to start with before I get into a couple of personal stories, because I don't have a children's story to share on this. I thought of Gollum and Precious, his Precious, the ring. And I thought, oh no, that's going to get abstract, or I don't have time to go into all the tangents I want to. So here's a poem by Rumi. In every breath, if you're the center of your own desires, you'll lose the grace of your beloved. But if in every breath you blow away your self-claim, the ecstasy of love will soon arrive. In every breath, if you're the center of your own thoughts, the sadness of autumn will fall on you. But if in every breath you strip naked, just like a winter, the joy of spring will grow from within. All your impatience comes from push for gain of patience. Let go of the effort and peace will arrive. All your unfulfilled desires are from your greed for gain of fulfillments. Let go of them all and they will be sent as gifts. Fall in love with the agony of love, not the ecstasy. Then the beloved will fall in love with you. Okay, so as I mentioned, I've experienced a great deal of becoming as a new LDL and stepping into this role and what does it mean and who am I now? And so one story is really old here, and another one, I'm going to do the second one first. Okay, so last week I participated in a Dharma talk, and this was a culmination of hours and weeks of studying and preparing and listening to Dharma talks and writing, and like 19 pages that winnowed down to 9. And I didn't tell anybody last week that it was my first Dharma talk. See, do you start to see how this is all a example of becoming, even the fact that I'm talking about it? And so I was really nervous after it was done. I got support from the other great local Dharma leaders who said, you know, good job, Susan. And I thought, you know, gosh, you know, I really had this high bar to reach. I made it so important. You know, I felt like I had to prove myself. And when I received the feedback, it was kind of surreal. I felt like I was on the team now. I was accepted. Like I could actually feel like I'm in the game. It was so important to me, this identification, in order for me to move forward in my life. It was as if I'd been given the ticket. But the truth was, I've been a local Dharma leader for a while, though I haven't just expressed my views here. So, and then I also realized that no amount of praise would probably fill the bucket, because I really didn't see myself as good enough because I kept comparing to others and this kind of thing. So after we got off of Zoom, we said our goodbyes. I was alone in my bedroom in this space I'm staying at. And I just had this utter, there was such a, that world ended right there. And I just experienced this utter sense of, I just described it to someone, a void, an ordinariness in just this emptiness of not having that becoming anymore. It left me, and there was that sense of almost kind of being let down. I say let down, but I don't think that's what it is. I think it was simply an emptiness where that becoming wasn't active. And then in the next moment, I saw my mind start to become, in a sense, in wanting to do something, get busy, do something next. What now? And my mind kind of ignored, bringing back that word ignorant. I ignored that kind of that stillness that kind of frightened me. And I saw my mind get busy, and it jumped to something I'd been thinking about just automatically. It jumped to, I need socks. And I remember, it's not the object, it's my relationship to the object. But so I saw myself go through this thing. Yeah, okay, I need socks. I'm starting to jog a little again. I need socks for my shoes. And that was that. I went and bought some socks. That was the next moment's ticket to happiness. that become that, and then that went away. The second one is something that I've hung on to. I've clung on in discussions with the other teachers about this month, or talk of becoming. My mind immediately went to something I identified with as a child, yet I still remember. And it was a doll. When I was 5 or 8, I wanted this doll so bad. It just represented a world to me. And it was just, it made me so excited and happy to think that I might get this doll. And so, and I actually remember the jingle, and I'm going to just sing you part of it because it's so, I think it's so telling. And so, who is the girl with the sparkle in her eye? It's Tammy, the ideal teen. Wow. So that essence of the doll created a whole world for me, a culture, an environment, a family, a way of being. I wanted to be that. And it was, I don't even know actually if I got the doll in the end, but so I hope what you're connecting to is that, you know, there's nothing bad or wrong. It's just part of our human nature to seek pleasure, you know, avoid, or, you know, want to be distracted with, well, for me, it was a pleasure in the moment, and not wanting to feel that just state of ordinariness of a human sentient being, as Lauren said. And another thing to remember is these links are not like one happens one time and another. They happen instantaneously. So this, so creating our next moment becomes something from which we remember, and we want that thing again. And another example of how this can happen is with addiction and alcohol. A person who's addicted to alcohol sees their world through that main objective, is to seek pleasure from the drink. And the whole world changes, and the experience of the person changes through that lens. And when recovery takes place and the addiction is ceased, that whole world is gone. So it arose, and then it went away. So in the words of Tenasaro Bhikkhu, he says, becoming constitutes a sense of self-identity located in a particular world. The contours of that self and that world are determined by a combination of old, comma, and new. Their location is determined by an act of craving and desire. So some of these questions come up maybe around karma, and I just understand that as it's a result of our actions, and it's reflected in the fifth recollection that states something like, the only thing that we have that's carried on is our actions, our verbal, physical, and mental, or our actions. That's our only luggage that we take with us. So the other way we take center stage is through our language. I love what Lauren asked. She said, I think she said something like, "Where are you? Is there a you?" And we have this kind of necessity. We have a language, and we use me, my, myself. But how we use the language can serve to strengthen that self-identification, personalization, or thin it. But we can't get around ourselves. The Buddha spoke about it this way. And this may sound a little this is hard to wrap your my mind around, but paraphrasing, if there's any designation of this existence through verbal language, words, knowledge, then we're going to keep suffering because we keep creating a me, and that me is fabricated. So what language do we use to define ourselves? Some of us, you know, we can do so in the ways of I'm a doctor, I'm an artist, I'm a lawyer, I'm a teacher, I'm a this, I'm a that, I'm a skier, I'm a mountain climber. Other ways we can increase that, build that sense of self by saying, you know, I'm stupid. I always make mistakes. I can't do that. I always forget. Or, man, I am good. I am so good. I'm better than everybody. I'm the best. Twary has mentioned in the past how we form identities and beliefs about ourselves by the age of five. So in a sense, we still operate from a five-year-old's view of who we are. And I remember a little girl in kindergarten who came up to me and asked me, Miss A, am I bad? And, you know, of course, you know, I said, oh, no, honey, no, no, no. But I saw in her eyes, she had already decided that even though in education we talk about mistakes are learning, you know, we all make mistakes. I still think kids associate a mistake with being bad. So she already had it. She already knew who she thought she was. On the other hand, you know, this meaning making and this selfing, it's, and this thing that our minds do, it's natural. We're human. This is what humans do. We're not, it doesn't make us wrong or bad. You know, our mind, our ego brings that sense of urgency and that we're always latching on to the next experience to be happy. And through this practice, we start to see that outside conditions don't bring happiness. Inside conditions do. And Rodney Smith likes to remind us that meditation practice is not a self-improvement project, that we don't need to be worked on or change ourselves. It's just about seeing who we really are. And what are we without our identity? Can we wear this sense of who we are a little more loosely? He says, our true nature is wordless awareness. Can we see ourselves rather than continuing ourselves? Another poem. By a Polish poet, Czesław Miłosz, and I took this from a talk I heard. I mean, I heard about this poem. It's beautiful. A valley and above it forests in autumn colors. A voyager arrives, a map leads him there, or perhaps memory. Once long ago in the sun, when snow first fell, riding this way, he felt joy, strong, without reason. Joy of the eyes. Everything was the rhythm of shifting trees, of a bird in flight, of a train on the viaduct, a feast in motion. He returns years later, has no demands. He wants only one most precious thing, to see purely and simply, without name, without expectations, fears, or hopes. At the edge where there is no I or not I. So some of the questions that I was hoping that we could consider for breakout today. Oh, maybe there is one part I didn't emphasize enough, and that is the sense that there's something I need in life to make me happy. Thus, my life will be complete when, we have this mental narrative that something is going to do that, either a thing or an experience, right? I mean, I had a horse, and that horse was my escape to happiness, though, my escape, you could say. You know, we have these midlife crisis things, and people buy cars or, you know, hot rod cars, something. There's some things that we kind of grasp onto for our identity and completeness. So here are a couple of questions to consider. And if you forget, I'll type them in the chat or in the breakout. I'll try to write them in the breakout. So for me to live in this world, to be content, to be happy, I need blank. And another question, what identity or mental narrative can you let go of? And here's one that's kind of fun and different. If you could be a single thing or a capacity or a capacity, what would you choose? Like a capacity that's manifesting, like ease, peace, kindness. Okay. And I will write those questions also for you. Alrighty. Have fun. So please open up your mics. Let's have a conversation. I'm interested to know what you connected with and how we could like extend the conversation or anything at all you'd like to share.
Well, I can just start, Ed, that we really hit all three questions, and it seemed like they were a nice variety. I personally was hesitant to do the one about the capacity. I don't know. I thought, I don't want to do that one. That's what I thought. But then one of the people in my breakout room did do it. And then it got me thinking, and I wondered why I didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
And then I realized that there was one that did, I really thought, oh yeah, that's kind of a lifelong one, and it's a challenge to me. So it was truth. And I mean, looking at truth, but I also have trouble with truth. So anyway, I ended up liking that one after all and finding it really helpful. So that's something that happened in our group.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Well, that's funny that I was exactly the opposite. I immediately came up with ease. It's what I was like that, and I didn't mind sharing it. But then thinking about, you know, my current if only, it was like, it sounds a little bougie, and I need a place on the island. So I was more hesitant to share that one. But for me, the ease was just automatic. And when we in meta meditation say, you know, may you live with ease, that just sounds like what the goal of all this is, you know, to allow things to come and go and to be in this more level, equanimous place with it. So that was automatic for me. And Susan, also, I want to thank you for the talk. It was lovely. And we both talked about that too, some aspects of it. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so glad it wasn't confusing. Or maybe it was, but you worked with it.
I thought that anecdote that you shared during the talk about the, and this was something that came up during our discussion, the five-year-old girl that asked, you know, am I bad? I thought that was, you know, a really interesting story. And I think it really has some carryover to adulthood too, right? Because I think that's an instinct that's easy to fall into, right? And I think one of the things that's, you know, beneficial about, you know, kind of like meditation, that practice is that it's kind of, it's reinforcement of the fact that there isn't necessarily this good or bad judgment that needs to be had about something, right? Things don't need to fall into this bucket of one or the other. And you know, even something as basic as getting distracted while you're meditating, right? I think it's easy to fall into like, oh no, I made a mistake, as opposed to, oh, this just happened. And, you know, that's just like, you know, your reality, right? And like, you, there's like acceptance with that, right? You just move on and you, you know, restart. So I thought that was like, I liked that, that story.
I just have to say, I, you know, as an educator, we get trained in certain language. And, you know, I said, I think I said, no, honey, you just made a mistake. And I realize now that I wouldn't say that now. I wouldn't even say that. I would say, you're, you know, you're beautiful, knowing where her mind was. I don't, you know, you're beautiful. You're, you know, touch her on the nose. You're perfect. You know, what does she need? This is part of the growth of like Dharma. What does that person need? What do they need for liberation? I didn't have that insight. I don't know if I completely have it, but I'm just saying there's a wisdom that grows when you know what someone else needs and you say that. So yeah, I don't have an answer right now. You,
what should I tell you?
Hello? Who said that?
My son talking. I unmuted, but he's sitting next to me.
Yes, does he have what I should have said?
No. I didn't know if it was okay to chime in. I liked all three questions very much. And I had a similar experience as Lauren, but with a different question. When you asked the questions, the answers came right to my head, but then my reluctance to actually be specific when I shared and say, oh yeah, you know, I had to come back to the question. I had to circle back and say, well, actually, you know, I'm very aware that I need to let go of maybe this one thing, my sailboat and my identity around it. And I found that it's interesting that the first question and the third question are kind of similar, but from a different angle, you know, like, what do you think you need, you know? And, but yet the way that the third one is being asked is very, there's an invitation to try to embody things that we kind of aspire to. And I think that I appreciate questions like that very much, because I carried those questions with me for days and try on different things, and that's a gift. So thank you for that.
Yes, you're so welcome.
We talked a little bit about what it would be like, you know, recognizing things that we're holding on to that are not helpful, how to unravel that, and do we want to? What are we, you know, what are we left with? You know, the idea, I guess, of having some fear of losing our identity, our ego, right? Is like, no, you can't jettison that, because that's who you are. So sort of how to work with this, seeing a little more clearly through practice and then not knowing what to do with it.
the standing still is like intolerable for like an addict without the substance to be without the substance. Utter, there are no words to express what that feels like. There's nothing there, you know, we don't know what to do. And to be able to sit, you know, it just, for me, it just keeps coming back to, and I know Lauren will talk about this next week, that stillness, how do you just, yeah, this too. This is what fear or whatever feels like. And to know that's enough and not have to figure it out.
A couple months ago, or I can't remember in what link we were talking about, I think this comes from Joseph Goldstein's mindfulness book about looking at the benefits of gratifying whatever the identity is or the desire, and also the non-benefits. What are really using our discernment in Gene? Because I know, you know, I think we do. We like weigh, well, what do I get out of this? You know, really, what do I get out of it? And what would it feel like to not get that? You know, I know I did a lot of that when I had to cleaned up my property, because I had so much identity as the junk lady on Westlake and how fun that was. And now people come by and they go, wow, I almost didn't recognize it. What is, you know, what's happened? And it's like, oh, okay. What, you know, can I still be special and not the junk lady? Or what is it about being special? I mean, are any of it, we're special and not special, you know, all of that. That just, I love that discerning process that kind of underlying Susan's questions of, you know, what would happen if we let go of it? What would that feel like? Yeah, I think it's a wonderful process. I appreciate the question.
And it reminds me too, we don't have to get rid of anything. Like I, you know, that I used to think I had to simplify my life, get rid of things. And then Rodney would say, you know, that's not quite it. It's more about your relationship, the mental clinging, you know, so it's not a movement to physically alter your space. It may be, there's no right or wrong. You know? Yeah, I mean, that's the trap too, to think there's a right way.
Could I speak to that for a moment?
Who said, yeah, Drew.
Yeah, that just that struck me, what you just said, because I love books, so I have an obsession a little bit here. We talked about obsession too, like, you know, book obsession, but I lent a book to a friend, and then that friend tore it up and put it on a canvas and painted over it without my permission. 25 years later, I'm still hanging on to that book, and I'm still upset that book got. And every once in a while, I go on Amazon and I look for it to see how much it costs. So there's some serious clinging, like, you know, like, you know,
yes, oh,
still $50, you know, like I'm still like,
oh,
sorry, Drew,
but okay, and then came back. We couldn't hear part of it, and then you came back.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't know what part you missed, but it was, I just could guarantee that if I got the book, if I purchased that book again, like it would just go on my shelf, right? And it would just sit there and collect dust. So,
right.
You know, it's
what a great, whatever comes up for us is what we get to look at. That's the other thing, to know that's what I get to look at, not, oh, there's got to be something better to improve me. But no, just look at this one thing, because the whole the whole world will expand. Okay, am I up? Okay, we should probably end there. Thank you so much for your participation.
Yeah, thanks everyone for the great discussion afterwards too.